This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, welcome to the latest Money and Markets podcast from AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. I'm Dan Coatsworth. This week's episode is all about interest rates and takeovers. From the Bank of England's latest rate decision to pain in the mortgage market, we'll explain how consumers and companies are feeling the pain. Joining me on this week's show is Tom Sieber.
Hi, Dan. Yeah, while rates are front and centre for most people right now, the takeover juggernaut keeps on trucking in the background. We'll be discussing the latest company to receive a bid and also look at a sector which is full of deals.
That's right. The biotech sector has burst into life this year. And we've got Dr. Rod Wong from investment trust RTW Venture on the show to explain why this is happening. But to kick things off, we'll first look at the implications of the Bank of England's latest interest rate decision. So, Tom, now we are recording this literally minutes after the announcement of a 50 basis point rise. So, what was the market reaction to it?
The market reaction, relatively muted if you look at the kind of the most relevant measure, which I guess is kind of gilt yields, which I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because most people did expect a 25 basis point increase. And obviously they've gone fairly hard, presumably after seeing the kind of recent signs of sticky inflation. 5% is worth putting in context. That's the highest rate we've seen in 15 years. And it pretty much extinguishes any kind of lingering hope that might have been that the bank was nearly done with rate hikes for now. Clearly, that's going to hurt businesses. It's going to really hurt mortgage holders. That's been a debate and a conversation that has dominated headlines for the last kind of week or so in particular. It's arguably better news for savers. And I guess key question mark is just how much this will pull down consumer spending and inflation if you've got older people who've paid off their mortgage and are benefiting from higher savings rates keep on spending. I know you're going to touch on that topic a bit later on, aren't you, Dan?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one of the things that sort of we've been seeing in the last couple of weeks is sort of the higher interest rates mean for companies is because they're definitely starting to see some pain. Of course, if interest rates are going up even further, then we could see even more of this. But just to give you some examples, house builder Barclay has warned that sales could fall by a fifth over the next year. And kind of what it was saying was that there's still lots of people interested in buying a house, but it's actually getting them over the line is harder to do. So it kind of said the deals that were going through were people who kind of had no choice but to either buy or sell. So whether that's because they've got divorced or perhaps there's been a death in the family. But of course, we're also reading about people being forced to downsize. So they're looking at saying, I just can't afford this, a higher mortgage rate if I've come to the end of my deal. I just have to have a smaller house. So because Barclay's sort of saying, clearly these higher borrowing costs are taking a toll on demand, but also actually within its business, because it sort of flagged to quite a few contractors that do work for the house builders. They've actually gone bust recently, either because they've underpriced their work or they just run out of cash. So we clearly got a problem in the house building sector. Travis Perkins is one of the big UK builders merchants. It's also saying higher interest rates and weaker consumer confidence are sort of hurting what's going on there. And of course, during the pandemic, we saw lots of people doing DIY projects and then they commissioned builders to do things. But now I think maybe people are saying, I can't afford to move house, but if I'm staying put, can I actually afford to have this extra work done as well? So yeah, lots of sort of problems there. And maybe just the other one to sort of point out is Motor Points, which is a sort of secondhand or nearly new car seller. It's saying that higher interest rates means that if you're taking out a finance package to pay for a car, well, that's suddenly become a lot more or a lot less affordable for lots of people. And its own debts. And this is a perfect example of a company that's got lots of debts. Its interest expenses doubled in the last financial year because, it's having to service that debt. So all in all, not a sort of great situation, but that doesn't mean to say everyone is in a bad patch. Isn't that right, Tom?
That is right. Yeah. I mean, it, interestingly, just to come back very quickly on the rate decision itself, there were two members of the nine strong committee who voted to keep rates on hold. They're sort of suggesting that you're already seeing some signs in forward facing indicators that inflation is going to ease a bit based on wages and prices. And they also pointed to the fact that you typically have a bit of a lag between rates being hiked and then that the impacts of that being felt in the economy. And so that, I mean, if you're looking for a bright spot, you know, maybe you'd look there. And I guess at the same time, you'd say that expectations rates might reach 6%, which is what the market was kind of pricing in, are looking increasingly credible. And there's also a chance of a UK recession. But as you point out, Dan, not all companies are struggling. So despite you've got, you know, the fact you've got this tough environment, even consumer facing companies, those that are kind of exposed to, you know, a potential drop in disposable income, are doing, well, some of them are doing all right. So Next recently upped its profit forecast. It got some help from sunny weather. You know, people were looking to refresh their summer wardrobes. And actually from wage increases as well, Simon Wolfson, the CEO of Next, was suggesting. And then London-centric pubs group, Fuller's, also had a positive update recently. I think, you know, what it was seeing is that more workers are coming back into the city. The sort of fashion for hybrid working is starting to bump up against the demands of employers for people to be in the office more. But I guess what both those examples show, even if they're benefiting from different things, is that if you have the right products and you can get it at the right price point, you can still thrive even if times are quite tricky.
And I guess the thing that perhaps quite a few people sort of underappreciate is that lots of people not everyone has a mortgage. So
no, exactly.
Someone might have been in a fortunate situation to have paid off their mortgage, or it might be that they're renting.
I had a friend I was speaking to yesterday who, not through any kind of great foresight, but just through some fortune, fixed his mortgage for 7 years, you know, last July. So, you know, he won't feel the impact of these interest rate rises potentially until, you know, we're through that rate cycle and things are looking a bit less difficult. So, you know, you're right. Although there's, you know, they talk about this mortgage time bomb, not everybody's exposed to that in the same way.
I think if you don't have a mortgage and you're perhaps sitting on some savings, well, a higher interest rate's actually good for you. So you get to a situation now thinking, well, you know, if you've got, if you do have savings, does that suggest that these people are still going to be spending lots of money? Therefore, could that fuel inflation? You know, just strong demand for stuff? Should rates actually be going, you know, interest rates be cut rather than going up? Or it might be actually, does that encourage more saving? Because they think, okay, you know, it's been so long since I've been able to get, you know, 5% on a cash savings account. Might this chunk of the population say, I'm going to put more money aside? So yeah, it's an interesting debate. I mean, maybe one that we can perhaps pick up on another sort of podcast. But I mean, I don't know, Tom, what sort of situation are you in at the moment?
I mean, you may remember me smugly saying I was on a fixed rate energy deal on the pods a few months back, maybe even sort of back end of last year. But now I'm in a slightly different position that I'm one of those people on a fixed rate mortgage, and I haven't been impacted by the rate hike yet. But it's on, you know, the horizon. It's only a matter of time, and I've got to start thinking about finding a new deal when the fixed term expires. And I think, you know, for all that we said, that doesn't apply to everyone. There are a lot of people in that situation. And if you are facing up to potentially quite a significant increase in your mortgage costs, or simply interested in what's going on in the mortgage market, you should find the next interview very illuminating.
Yeah, Laura Souter recently caught up with David Hollingworth from the mortgage brokers LNC to discuss the dilemma of, you know, should someone fix their mortgage or stay on a variable rate deal? So before we hear what David had to say, it's just worth noting this interview was recorded before the latest Bank of England rate decision. So they might be talking about some things which are obviously no longer applicable. Mortgage deals are changing on a daily basis at the moment, and sort of lenders are you know, I don't know, you hear a product and then you hear stories of like 2 hours later, it's no longer available. It's a very fast moving market. But you know, David will certainly give you an overview exactly what's going on. And, you know, let's hear what he had to say now.
So today we want to ask a question of whether you should fix or get a tracker. So we've just had the news that a typical 2-year fixed rate mortgage deal now has an average interest of more than 6% for the first time since December. Obviously, those rates are subject to change and keep changing very regularly, but it's clearly causing some people to be a bit reticent about fixing if they're up for a remortgage. Obviously, it depends a lot on the individual and their circumstances, but let's try and tackle the different parts of it first. So first up, if you're weighing up a fix versus a tracker or variable rate mortgage, what do you need to think about, David? What are the kind of first questions you should be asking yourself?
Well, if you boil it back to basics, really, you're talking about something which is variable and therefore it's going to rise and fall as interest rates go up and down. So you haven't got the security that a fixed rate gives you. So fixed rates do exactly what they say on the tin, and you'll know exactly what rate you're going to pay for a specific period of time. And so you can therefore just plan your budgeting around that, knowing mortgage payment isn't going to be subject to rise and fall. Trackers, meanwhile, are directly pegged to the base rate. So they'll be tracking the base rate by a certain margin. So if base rate does continue to climb, which is what markets are expecting, then your mortgage rate will climb too, and your monthly payments will rise. But equally, the benefit is if we get into a downward rate movement, then a tracker rate will follow that down. So you could actually find yourself with a lower rate rather than being stuck on a higher fixed rate. Because there's a lot to do with timing here, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it depends on kind of the individual, the homeowner's view of what's going to happen with interest rates, which in normal times it's easier to predict. At the moment, it's really hard. So at the moment, as it stands, what do we think is going to happen with rates? What are some of the, you know, the things people should be factoring in with rate rises when they're weighing up which mortgage to go for?
Yeah, so post mini budget, we saw a lot more people using trackers just potentially as a holding position, but fixed rates had gone up so rapidly and so high that a tracker rate, even though base rate was anticipated to rise, looked that much cheaper. We're now into a position where we've got another phase of volatility feeding through. And that's because inflation rates are a lot more stubborn than people had hoped. So rather than base rate nearing the peak, there's an expectation that base rate is going to have to rise further and stay higher for longer than had been previously anticipated. Now, we don't know whether that will actually be what happens. But if you're looking at a tracker rate now, it may start to look somewhat cheaper than a fixed rate. But that's because it's not reacted to any base rate rises. If there are further base rate rises to come, it will rise. What we are seeing in fixed rate market, though, they are reacting to the changes in market expectation that's pushing lenders' costs up, which is feeding straight through into mortgage rates. And we're getting rather higher fixed rates than we had even a month ago.
And I think for some people, it's the kind of fear factor of a 2-year fixed rate mortgage and the worry that they're going to be fixing at the top of the market or very near the top of the market. But how do you as an individual, not, you know, like an economist or someone who works for the Bank of England, how do you as an individual homeowner make that call?
So I think it's very difficult to second guess what's going to happen. And we can see that just from the recent changes, how quickly that's just sped into a rapid increase in fixed rates. So natural inclination for many will be to know where they stand, and therefore a fixed rate will suit them. But as you say, the concern can be about being left high and dry on a higher rate. The behavior we've started to see is that homeowners are starting to use shorter-term fixed rates. We've very much seen 5-year market be much more popular in recent years because rates were very, very similar or even a bit cheaper. But now people are worried about whether actually inflation will start to ease. Base rate may start to come down in time and they don't want to be left on a fixed rate for that much longer. So there's a little bit of a shift back to the use of shorter term deals, even though the rate will be a bit higher than you could get on a 5-year rate. And that's because they want to review again in a couple of years' time. Now, of course, what we don't know is what the rate environment will look like in 2 years' time. could ease back. It could be that they will have slightly better rates to choose from at that point in time. But there's absolutely no guarantee. I think if you're looking at tracker rates, useful thing to do is actually say, well, okay, if rates do go up by another 1% or more, what does that start to look like on the kind of tracker rate I can get today? How do I feel about those monthly payments? Play around with an online calculator. And that will help you see what kind of appetite you have for those increases in rates, rather than just focusing on what if rates start to come back down in the future. It's just stress testing your own budget.
And we talk about, when we're talking about the fixed rate market, we talk about, you know, 2-year fix, 5-year fix, sometimes 10-year fix, although I think those discussions are kind of off the table at the moment. But does a 1-year fixed rate deal exist? Is that a product that's out there, you know, where people could tide over, fix for a year, and then see what the interest rate environment is like at that point?
Good question. I don't think it's an established market, so you're not going to find lots of lenders offering 1-year fixed rates. But actually, that's the kind of thing perhaps lenders could start looking at if we're seeing this concern around whether rates will actually start to fall back again next year, and people are therefore hesitating about doing anything. I mean, that's the worst thing you can do. Possibly end up straying onto standard variable rate, which are hitting 8% or more in some cases. But a kind of 1-year deal, something along those lines. Tracker rates don't carry penalties, so that's why those can give a little bit more flexibility. But you have got that lack of certainty. So, yeah, absolutely. I think there's no reason why you couldn't see 1-year fixed rates, but it's not an established market.
With those tracker deals, I mean, we talk a lot about the pricing in the fixed rate market, don't we? And we've, you know, new headlines every day at the moment about what the average 2-year fixed rate deal's gone to. But what about trackers? Is there still competition in that market between providers of kind of, because you pay the base rate plus a bit, don't you? Is that plus a bit fairly standard across the industry, or is there competition there at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, that margin that you're talking about is really where you're looking for, you know, what's the best deal for me. So at the moment, you could be looking at a 2-year tracker with a rate 0.15 above base, so you'd be currently paying 4.65. but of course, we're expecting base rate to shift this week, and there may be more moves to come, so you've got to just look at the margin. But yeah, there is competition. It's not a huge number of base rate trackers, but as I say, one of the advantages of them is that actually you can get these with no early repayment charges at any time. So it does leave your options open a little. It's just that if or when you choose to jump to a fixed rate, you may find that fixed rates are more expensive again than what they are currently.
And so, I mean, that's a really good point that some people probably wouldn't be aware of about trackers, you know, not having that early repayment penalty. Are there other things that you need to think about when you're weighing up a tracker versus a fixed rate deal that's not purely based just on the rates decision?
So some of them will have early repayment charges, but lenders have recognized that, you know, borrowers are a little bit cautious about whether that's going to be the right option. So they may even have a switch to fix. Now, that limits your options a bit more than having no penalties at all, but it could allow you to jump onto one of the lender's fixed rates further down the line. You'd then still have to, of course, look at what kind of fees you might be paying, because, of course, you could be doubling up on that switch. So those fees could start to mount up and erode some of the benefits. But it does give people some opportunity to have a more flexible position. Also allows for overpayments for those who perhaps do have some spare cash. Not easy in this current climate, of course, but it could give a little bit of more flexibility than you'd be anticipating with a fixed rate where overpayment facilities will be typically up to 10% per annum.
And for those people who opted for a tracker last year after that kind of like mini budget market mayhem that happened, and is still sitting on a tracker now, kind of not sure when to pounce and when to go into the fixed rate market, what would your advice be to them?
I think anyone looking actually at a fixed rate, whether they're on a tracker right now or not, it's a difficult decision. But what you can do is secure a rate, even, you know, some time from the end of your current fix rate, if you're still fixed, or your track rate, lock a deal in, and then keep that under review. So mortgage offers are typically valid for up to 6 months. So if you're worried that fixed rates might carry on climbing, but you're also thinking things could stabilize again, then you could take a deal, have it in your hand, and just wait to see how things pan out. That at least means you've secured a rate right now, but you would have that 6 month grace period to use that deal. If they do come back down, then it would allow you to review that position and switch on to a lower rate potentially. But at the moment, the direction travel fixed rate is definitely up. And of course, you have to anticipate the tracker rates are going to follow as base rate rises feed through.
And if you're in that conundrum, what's the worst thing that you could do right now?
So I think we did see some people post mini budget decide that standard variable rate, because suddenly it looked pretty much on par with the fixed rates that were on offer, they just held firm on standard variable rate. But of course, that was because base rate was expected to rise further. Those base rate increases have fed through now already, and we're expecting more to come. So standard variable rates have already shifted that much higher. And if you're on a variable rate at 8%, you can still, despite all of the volatility in the fixed rate market, you can still be fixing at around 5% or even below that slightly on a five-year deal. So you would still be making some rather substantial savings over standard variable rate. I think don't do nothing, keep it under close review and just be aware of what the options are to you.
Thank you so much for that, for explaining all of that. It's going to be really helpful for those people having to run the gauntlet of the mortgage market at the moment. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
So before everybody gets too depressed and we sort of dive too much into doom and gloom, let's move on to the world of takeovers, as there continue to be a lot of deals, particularly in the UK. Now, the latest name to attract bid speculation is the web-based food delivery outfit Ocado. What's interesting with Ocado, it's had quite an interesting trajectory sort of over the last few years. Its shares soared during the pandemic, and it made its way up to the FTSE 100. A lot of that was about the excitement for the potential for it to sell what is essentially a kind of out-of-the-box online groceries solution. It for its own purposes, uses robot pickers in large warehouses to fulfill its orders, and it was looking to kind of sell that as a solution to global supermarkets. Didn't really see the volume of deals maybe that people hoped for during the pandemic, and it kind of blamed the pandemic and the fact that it couldn't meet up with people in person for that. But even now the world has opened up, there haven't really been that kind of volume of big deals required to keep investors excited about the company. It's also had sort of technical problems. It's had kind of fires with the robots, and it had a patent dispute and various kind of operational issues. And once you add all that together, the shares are trading at just a fifth of what they were in early 2021 when they kind of hit an all-time high. So that's the backdrop. But what we've seen is a 30% plus surge in the shares on rumors that Amazon is interested in buying Ocado. You know, if it's to be believed that Amazon's interest is real, then it suggests that for all the fact that it's had all these troubles, third parties still see some value in Ocado's brand and its technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hasn't sort of lived up to the hype of signing up these people around the world. I think a lot of people just focus on this venture it's got in the UK with Marks and Spencer, but I think if you talk to the company, they would argue they're not really a delivery company. It's all about the systems and processes for you know, running these gigantic warehouses, and the idea that you've got a business here with shows how it's done with you know, little robots and efficiencies and technology. You can see why Amazon might want to do that. Of course, Amazon's been dipping its toes into sort of the food area for a while with its fresh stores and more. And I guess there's logic to it.
Absolutely, and I guess in its Ocado's sort of diminished state, it's not going to be a massive outlay for a company like Amazon to make that kind of acquisition. I think you're right. I think, you know, there are reasons why you can see logic to a transaction like that.
And so there are other deals happening on the market. So whilst a lot of people's attention is just focused on sort of inflation, interest rates, these deals are bubbling away quite nicely in the background. And the latest one is Lookers, the car retailer. It's just quite interesting because if you go back a few years, it was in ever so much trouble. Probes into its accounts and shares are suspended for quite a while. But actually, if you would took the risk and bought those shares in 2020, you would have made 10 times your money since then, which is quite remarkable. So it's had a £1.20 bid from Alpha Auto. That's a sort of a Canadian company. And you know, this is a sort of a trend in the car retail sector. We've had bids in the last couple of years from Marshall Motors and Cambria Automobiles. I guess the key attraction for this part of the market is car retailers often are sitting on, you know, owning lots of property. So the sites where their forecourts are, you know, they'll own that property. And so they've got really sort of strong asset backing on their balance sheet. Lookers was sitting on £66 million of net cash and a property portfolio worth £290 million. So added up together, that's 92 pence per share. So Alpha's come along and said, I'll give you £1.20, £1.20 for this business. So essentially, they've got a trading business making £83 million profit a year. It looks like they've got quite a big deal here. So, I mean, it's just a classic example of a smaller company where lots of people in the market thought, okay, it's done, you know, it's had a patchy past. No one's really interested in small caps at the moment, but someone has come on and thought, okay, there's some real big value here. And lo and behold, we've had a takeover offer. And this is, you know, it's a trend that keeps going. And no doubt we'll see lots more of this stuff coming up.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, as well as the car retailers, the biotech space has been a fertile ground for takeovers this year. To find out why and find out a bit more about it, we thought it'd be useful to bring in an expert. So Rod Wong is the Chief Investment Officer of RTW, which specializes in backing companies with innovative drug developments. Its RTW Venture Investment Trust is listed on the Stock Exchange in London and has recently seen companies in its portfolio receive takeover bids. Dan spoke to Rod to find out about this trend and to better understand investing in biotechs more generally. So let's hear what he had to say.
So Rod, investing in biotech or pharmaceutical companies, incredibly risky. So how do you spot the best opportunities?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Dan. It's really changed a lot over the years. So, you know, when I started in the business 20 years ago, if you had a couple of folks with, you know, some advanced scientific degrees, maybe some clinical experience, and they were hardworking, you could really cover a lot of ground. I think the reality of that time was there wasn't a whole lot of innovation, so you could follow it. Today, it's completely different. Innovation's been exploding. We've been trying to evolve our firm to keep up with it. So for example, at RTW, we have close to 80 people. We have over 24 advanced degrees now. And it's not just about the quantity of talent. You know, we've sub-specialized that talent by, you know, things including disease area and technology. And we also have special teams within that where they're covering things like, for example, medical conferences, which we process chasing science around, you know, 200 plus conferences a year, where we have sub-teams that develop relationships with universities that track genetic data. You know, we even have newer efforts to track things on social media. And of course, we're thinking about how AI might play into all of this in the future.
I know that small companies in this sort of space, they do typically burn through lots of cash. And, you know, quite often these trials can last for years. I mean, how patient do you really need to be? And, you know, at what point do you actually sort of say, we're going to have to walk away from investment because it's just simply not worked?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think of it at the end of the day, when we look at any investment, we're always trying to solve two big questions, right? So one is the odds of success. And then two is if everything works and a transformative therapy or product makes its way to patients, what is the ultimate value of that success, right? So then if you kind of think about it that way, everything else is then from here to that point or the steps along the way. And you know, it's gets a little bit into the art of investing where you have to think about what is the risk reward along the path. So there's obviously a fair amount of art to this. You have to understand the kind of market environment that you're in at any given time. And you know, one of the big challenges with this is that backdrop can change, as we've seen in the last couple of years, significantly. So I think, you know, biotech, when you think about long short equity investing, biotech is probably one of the ones that's the most bipolar. You know, it's, people get very optimistic and then they get very, very pessimistic. So I think it goes without saying, you know, in our space, risk management is really important. I think it's probably fair to say that in biotech specifically, you know, when you layer in the kind of considerations that we're a sector that has higher top-down vol, it also has this binary nature to it. You know, risk management is really critical to long-term success.
I know that you've had a couple of companies that are in your portfolio have been taken over for quite large premiums. I was just wondering if you think that we're perhaps at the start of a sort of a new wave of sort of takeovers in the biotech or broader pharma space.
The short answer, I think, is a resounding yes. You know, to expand on that just a little bit, in the back half of this decade, so beginning 2025, the majority of the 12 largest multinational pharmas, they're going to be facing major patent expiries, right? So losing significant amounts of revenue. And basically all of them are pretty vocal that business development is a key priority for them. And even the remainder of the pharmas that aren't facing as large of patent cliffs, they're also still active because for them, they can, of course, take the opportunity to add to their growth potential. And we're seeing this, right? In just the last few months, we're seeing, I think, some deal momentum. In December, Amgen announced that they're going to acquire Horizon. That's close to a $30 billion deal. In March, Pfizer announced the plan to acquire Seagen. That's a very big deal. I think the largest since 2019. That was over $40 billion. And then just very recently in April, Merck announced a deal to acquire Prometheus for just over $10 billion. This last one, the Prometheus deal, is I think kind of interesting because that was pre-revenue. And they're actually just at the beginning of doing their phase three registration trials. So you can see that, you know, these pharmas are really planning ahead. In Merck's case, probably preparing for the Keytruda patent expiries, which will start, you know, their revenues could start declining closer to 2030.
Is that normal for you know, large companies to take that risk to buy a company before it's, you know, if it's still in the trial phase? It seems, I would have thought that they would be happy to wait for the risk to be lower when everything's sort of proved and ready to go.
That is definitely the case, that it's easier to get those kinds of deals done, right? The ones that have been de-risked. But I think the reality is that sometimes those deals become too expensive. And these patent expiries are such a significant challenge that pharmas have to be a little bit more aggressive than that.
But obviously, when you look to invest in a company, are you thinking about takeover potential at all? Or are you just sort of thinking, actually, we're looking for someone with the best ideas, best potential to grow earnings, and therefore sort of the value of the business?
Yeah, I'd say both. You know, at a high level, I think at the end of the day, you know, the reality is that for almost all biotechs, right, it's much more efficient for them to focus on innovating rather than to try to build, you know, definitely a global sales infrastructure, especially for, you know, a single medicine, right? So usually for a biotech, ultimately selling to some multinational company is a win for everybody that's involved, right? You get access to this global sales infrastructure. That means the medicine gets to patients more quickly, much more efficiently. And then entrepreneurs also win, and investors can redeploy that capital and do it again, right? So that said, though, our strategy, you know, we're often involved in companies much earlier, you know, beginning much earlier in the life cycle. So you can imagine, you know, when we're first making an investment in a company, we're often then looking for much larger returns, you know, 3, 5, 10x returns. So takeover potential is definitely something that we think about, but it tends to come into play in kind of the final act of a company, right? The final 30 to 50 to 100% return.
When you're investing, are you sort of looking for companies that do certain things. I'm just wondering, for example, if ones that are trying to develop treatments for rare conditions, might that come with higher profit margins for their earnings? Or do you want a company that's developing a treatment that might become mainstream and therefore high volume sales later on?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, coincidentally, an early part of our reputation in the business came from some success that we had investing specifically in rare diseases. So there are a handful of companies that have mattered a lot to our firm, for example, Alexion, Alnylam, and AveXis. From a financial perspective, the downside, I guess, of investing in more rare diseases is obviously these are smaller populations by definition, and so the commercial opportunities are smaller. But I think in all three of the kind of examples I just ticked through, these were companies that had drug candidates for diseases that had incredibly high unmet need, right? And the medicines also had clear biology, and they were showing, kind of exciting potential to have a really transformational benefit to patients. And so we kind of used those aspects kind of as our guiding principles, it's led to good returns for us. I'll forever remember the day that AveXis first presented the results of their gene therapy treatment for this terrible disease, spinal muscular atrophy, at a medical conference. These SMA patients, this is a disease where the babies will never be able to even sit up on their own. They don't have use of their muscles, before they pass away at a couple of years old. And when AveXis played the videos of some of the treated kids, one kid was probably around kindergarten age, was walking down a hallway and pressing an elevator button like a normal kid would. And the entire room, doctors, some patient advocates stood up and cheered. It was an incredible moment. So I think, for us, investing in rare diseases has always been a part of our legacy. Today, I think one of the great things, though, about innovation is that as disease understanding has improved, you're more often seeing these kind of transformational benefits and uncovering clear biology, even for pretty common diseases, right? Especially in areas like immunology. And you're seeing now for actually the most common disease of them all, or condition, obesity, right? That's being transformed right now. So at the end of the day, I think, if you prioritize unmet need and transformational benefit, that actually leads to very good investment decisions. And I'll just end with, for us, of course, there are limits to the commercial model. You can't justify investing in a product being developed for a disease that might only have a few hundred patients, for example, right? But for that reason, because it's become so ingrained as part of our mission, we actually formed a charitable foundation to be able to support those therapies when they look promising, even when there isn't kind of a for-profit path for that medicine.
Oh, fantastic. So, I mean, what just before we let it go, could you sort of perhaps talk about, is there one or two companies in your portfolio at the moment that are really doing something really clever, and you think actually these are going to be names that you'll want to know in the future?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you two examples that kind of for different reasons. So one is a company called Cargo. This is a recent private investment that we made. I think Cargo is a great example of the exciting innovation that you're seeing in new modalities, in this case, in cell therapy. So actually the largest cancer conference of the year, ASCO, was just last weekend. And I think one of the biggest takeaway messages from that conference is that cell therapy is becoming standard of care in certain cancers like lymphoma, because it's showing higher cure rates than we've seen with really any other form of therapy before. From a financial perspective, cell therapy is already doing now north of $2 billion in sales globally, even though you may have heard there are manufacturing challenges. And ultimately, as a class, probably headed to over $10 billion in sales. But despite that incredible progress, there's still probably about 70% of lymphoma patients that won't be cured by a cell therapy. And Cargo has a next generation cell therapy that's shown high response rates in the first couple of dozen patients that they've treated out in a trial run by Stanford in California. So we're really excited about that one. Another one is less so about maybe the most cutting edge scientific innovation, but just an opportunity that exists in this specific market environment because there's been such a significant correction in over the last 2 years. So this is actually a royalty investment that we made in a company called Avidel. Earlier this year, Avidel was trying to raise the capital that they needed to launch a drug that they've developed for narcolepsy. And the drug is called Lumryz. The current standard of care to treat narcolepsy is a drug called Xyrem, and it's taken at bedtime. But because of the short half-life of that drug, patients have to wake up in the middle of the night to take a second dose. So Lumryz has fixed that. It's an extended release formulation of basically the same active ingredient, and you just have to take it once before bedtime, and it works just as well. So this is a clear benefit that's materially improved the lives of these narcolepsy patients. Anyways, in an environment like this one, it's really difficult for a small company like Avidel to raise the, $200 million plus dollars, $200 million plus that they need to launch the drug, even though the drug is obviously better, right? So this is a good example of a drug that probably wouldn't be a blockbuster drug, right? It's a smaller disease indication. So we are ultimately able to help the company get this done. And in this case, we combined a traditional equity deal with a royalty financing. And I think the really nice thing about royalties as a financing tool, in this environment is that they have better downside protection because we actually don't provide the capital if the drug doesn't launch for some reason. And then we share in a percentage of the revenue. So it's not actually reliant on a small company being able to achieve profitability, right? So it's got better downside protection for that reason. But at the same time, it still shares linearly in the upside of the opportunity. So for a completely different reason, but it's also exciting investment in the portfolio.
Well, Rod Wong from RTW, thank you ever so much for coming on the podcast. That was really, really interesting. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
That's all from us this week. Don't miss next week's show where Dan will be talking to Ben Ritchie from Dunedin Income Growth on what's been learned in the investment trust's 150-year history. Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next time.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you whether certain investments are suitable or not. And don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that tax rules apply, and that the way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor. Thank you.